How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Calling It Podcast. Alex Barth along with Alex Lebowitz, powered by CLNS Media, recording on Monday, April 29th at 7:30. We've got a lot to get to, Lebowitz, so we'll do the quick pleasantries, good or bad?
Good.
Good. All right, good. Let's get right into it. The Celtics, we haven't talked about the Celtics in a long-ass time because they played a, I don't want to say meaningless series against the Pacers. Maybe there's a better word for it, but it was very clear who the better team was in that series. And maybe I undersold it. I did not realize how lopsided it was. I knew it was lopsided. I did not realize it was that lopsided.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was really taking that series too seriously, just because their best player was out, Victor Oladipo, and that's kind of right. The heart of their offense. Without him there, they were pretty much stagnant. They weren't good. They weren't exciting to watch. Defensively, they played well, but again, the Celtics have so much more talent than the Pacers, so I think everyone was taking that series with a grain of salt. This is really where people were really looking at. How are they going to do against Giannis and this Bucks team, the number one team in the Eastern Conference? And game one, I mean, overwhelmingly positive, and that's yeah. The response from the fans.
I mean, we were originally supposed to record Sunday like a preview, and then I was dead from the draft, and you were dead from, I don't know, shenanigans, hooligans.
The Bruins,
that double overtime, yeah.
Yeah.
I barely made it through that game after 3 days of the draft, but I'm very glad we didn't record because I was not expecting that. Not at least not game one in Milwaukee. I did not think that was happening. And I have campaigned all season on the idea that they cannot flip a switch, that this is who the team is. They might have flipped the switch. I might have been wrong.
Yeah. And I think the thing that was, pretty telling about where they're at right now is, you know, they took that initial lead to start the game. It was a 15 points, 20 points in the first quarter. They were controlling the game, hitting their shots. The spacing was wonderful. And then the Bucks got into it, and by halftime, I think the lead was only two, but they had slipped at one point. They were down. And then they took over again. So you have a team that, you know, starts off hot and played a little bit inconsistently, but overall, they hit their shots when it mattered, and they play like a team that's playing, you know, that has some cohesion. Not really. It doesn't seem like there are any problems that we had in the locker room prior to the postseason starting. And overall, they're hitting on all cylinders. This is the Celtics who we expected coming into this year, and to have Gordon right. Hayward playing as well as he is, and you know Al Horford, who's been one of the more valuable players on this team.
I mean, we need to give Al his own like minute or two on this show because that might be the best game he's played in the Celtics uniform, offensively and defensively.
It's the most valuable he's been, given the job he did on Giannis. That block was awesome. Unbelievable. And, you know, people call him boring Al and whatnot. He's played
that
like a max player.
That
he played like a
boring.
Max. Yeah,
he's been unreal. That back at Giannis's face.
He's played like a max player. I mean, that's the best way to put it. He's played like a max deal guy. And without him on the floor yesterday, Giannis does whatever he wants, I think. Or not whatever he wants, but he scores more than, 22 points? They held him.
I mean, he wasn't impactful. Like, he put up big numbers, but they weren't in big moments, I guess, is the way what I'm trying to say. I don't know if you can phrase it better than that. I'm still a little fried mentally. But, he scored – you didn't notice him score 22. It wasn't a dominant 22. It just sort of happened in the pace of the game while the Celtics were able to dominate. There weren't a lot of consecutive points from Giannis. He didn't go on many of these individual runs like he's known to go on. They really maintained the – they gave him – what he was going to get. They weren't too worried. You know, they knew going in, all right, he's going to get 20 points. And sometimes against superstar players, this is something LeBron has made a living on. Teams will, once he got later in his career, start picking up the assist numbers. You sort of saw it the other way, actually. And the Bucks fell into this trap with Kyrie. They got so concerned about completely eliminating him from the game that it opened up opportunities elsewhere on the floor. And the Celtics sort of said, if Giannis scores 20, he scores 20. We can win if he does that, as long as he doesn't get into the 30 or 40 range. So they gave him his 20. They took away the secondary opportunities. And that's where the Bucks struggled, which is ironic because that's where everybody thought the Bucks are going to kill the Celtics in this series. That's where the Bucks have given the Celtics trouble before. Now, they don't have Malcolm Brogdon, and he's normally a key component in that secondary scoring. But the Celtics dared the Bucks to win that game without Giannis, and they couldn't do it. And now we see in game two, I would not be surprised if the Celtics extend the same challenge. And can the Bucks rise to it?
And that is the question. And this is a well-coached team, the Bucks, that is.
Yeah, so very few in the NBA that you can give that moniker to.
Honestly. So if there's a team that will adjust, it's them. This series, there's some people who are like, it's done. Paul Pierce being one of them.
I love Paul Pierce. Like, you got to love that. That's why the 07-08 Celtics were great, because they all had that kind of blind confidence. And they could back it up. And it was awesome. I don't know if this team could back it up, but I just love Paul Pierce for that.
Well, it's that blind confidence that the Celtics kind of had all year. Even when they were losing, it's like, we'll pick it up. We'll snap
last
into it.
Last year they really had that kind of confidence.
Oh, Rozier?
For him. Yeah.
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 No, you're right. And that's, they do have a chip on their shoulder. Like, that's certainly the thing about this team. They have, Jaylen Brown, who's a guy who's, been criticized a ton this season. Kyrie Irving, he's always been criticized. Marcus Morris, Marcus Smart, obviously, and Rozier. They have personalities on this team and guys who were flat-out competitors, like them or not. But those personalities were, in conflict all season long. Now they're playing like a team that's, that likes playing with each other.
That we thought they would be.
Exactly.
The team we thought they would be.
And just one more thing. You talk about the Bucks not being able to answer when they need to go to their secondary options outside of Giannis. This is a point that Paul Pierce made. The Celtics have that depth. They have options.
Oh, yeah.
They
have other guys. Jaylen's playing his best basketball of the year, and that's huge.
Of course, yeah. And they're playing, well defensively, which is another big key. So it's hitting on all cylinders. You cannot complain if you're a Celtics fan.
So if you'll allow us to look down the road a little bit here, I had said before the series, and I still think this is true, even with the outcome of Game 1, two of the most important people in the series did not play in Game 1, and that is Malcolm Brogdon and Marcus Smart. And to me, a lot of this series is going to hinge on if and when those two come back, because I mentioned the Bucks' issues with secondary scoring. Brogdon comes back, that changes the entire picture. Obviously, we know what Marcus Smart does for the Celtics, and as good as they played in Game 1, I'm not sure if Marcus Smart adds another 10 points to that lead if he plays in that game, and the tenacity he brings in. I mean, it's no secret what I think of Marcus Smart. So that, to me, now becomes the next storyline. Does Marcus Smart come back in the series? Does Malcolm Brogdon come back in the series? Does either one of them have, a period of assimilation, kind of like, to throw back to the Bruins, we saw with Sean Corrali when he wasn't much of a factor in Game 5 and then comes in and essentially is one of the top three players for the Bruins and wins in Game 6 and 7. And part of it to me is who gets their guy back first. Because if the Celtics get Marcus Smart back first, that's a huge emotional boost. They can carry that for a couple games and maybe take the series in those couple games. If the Bucks get Malcolm Brogdon back first, maybe they start to go on a run, win a couple games, the Celtics get dejected. We've seen that this year. Well, at the same time, let's say both guys come back in the same game, I could see them canceling each other out. So that's the interesting dynamic for me at this point, is if and when Marcus Smart and Malcolm Brogdon come back, because I think those two guys have a huge potential to change the way the series is going at whatever point it is they come back.
Both guys are kind of X factors for their respective teams. So, I mean, when either of them comes back, it's going to be a huge boost. And obviously for the Celtics, they're playing well, and they're all right without them. They don't need Marcus Smart, dare I say. If there's one team that needs their guy more, it's obviously the Bucks. And if he does come back, yeah, you said it. Maybe that's 10 extra points, or that's a 20-point swing potentially that could, sway a game in Milwaukee's favor. Definitely something to look forward to. But right now it doesn't seem like Smart's coming back for the series. At least that's not something that I'm anticipating. And I just don't know about Brogdon's injury to see if he will come back. Either way, though, even if Brogdon comes back, Smart doesn't. The edge is with the Celtics. They're playing really well. And as
what
I said
I'm saying
earlier,
is Brogdon has the potential to flip that edge, is the way I see it.
But the Celtics
he's going to inject life into that team.
Of course. Maybe that is the case. And it would take some pressure off of Giannis. But given how deep the Celtics are with or without Marcus Smart, you'd think that they'd be able to rise up to that challenge. That said, Game 2 is going to be a lot tougher, in my opinion, than Game 1. And this isn't going to be a sweep by any stretch. The Bucks are too good of a team.
If this is a sweep, we can start talking about a legitimate – we can legitimately start talking about them in the wars. I do believe whoever wins this series, this is the Eastern Conference Finals. I think Toronto is not built for a deep postseason run, and I think Philly might be the most overrated team in the NBA. So whoever comes out of this series, I think, is going to the finals.
Yeah, potentially. I don't know. I'm still worried about the Raptors. I think the Raptors.
No, it's the Raptors. You know. It's like the Maple Leafs. Remember what I said about the Maple Leafs? They lose. They lose in April. It's what they do. I said the same thing about the Lightning. They lose. It's what they do in April. Sometimes it's in the first round. Sometimes it's in the second. Sometimes it's in the third. They lose. They don't get there. They don't get to the biggest stage. Toronto Raptors are one of those teams. It's the entire city of Toronto, except for the Blue Jays, because they can't win. And I did the anti-Toronto rant last week, so I won't go down that road.
Yeah, no, Quebec is the Canada or France for poor people.
All right.
But people said the same thing about the Capitals. So that's true up until that team in whatever year it is proves that theory wrong. So I don't put a bunch of stock in that. Maybe you're right, but they didn't have Kawhi Leonard last year, right? So
they did have DeMar DeRozan.
They did, but Kawhi's better, in my opinion.
Fair. All right. I do want to move to, before we get to our final thoughts, the other side of the bracket in the West, because obviously you have drama between the Rockets and the Warriors. Who would have thought? And I just think that I want to root for the Rockets so bad because I don't like the Warriors. It annoys me that I don't like super teams. I don't like Steph Curry. He's getting, you know, when the guy's like too squeaky clean, and it's not even that I think he has skeletons. I just think it's annoying how much of a perfect person. I guess this is how most people probably feel
he's
about
douchey.
Tom Brady. But not. That's the thing. He should be, and he's not, and that's what bothers me.
I think he's douchey.
Probably how much you feel about Tom Brady. I'll admit, whatever. I don't want to root for the Warriors. I actually kind of like the Rockets. I enjoy watching James Harden. I've always been a fan of Chris Paul. They've got Gerald Green. I'm a huge Gerald Green guy. Like, I want that team to win some ball games, but. When you come out with an actual report that talks about the officials costing you 18 points, just get some balls. Just go play better. Go earn those 18 points then. I thought that was annoying. And the whole thing about, you know, the shooter needs room to land in that whole rule and the call on Harden at the end of the game, which sure, in real speed did look like a foul. These guys are essentially long jumping into their shots. And it's a creative idea. It's kind of like in football when you lean into pass interference, or in baseball and you don't totally get out of the way of the pitch. Like, they're not really breaking the rule. It's just super, super suspect. But you shouldn't be relying on a gimmick to win you games at this point. I don't know. I'm very annoyed by the Rockets in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, I think it's always, you know, when you audit a game, like if you go to that length.
You just don't need to do that.
It leaves a bad taste in your mouth, and it's. I won't say it's sore loserish because at this level, it's high stakes. I get it, and
the NBA embraces this mentality with that stupid last 2 minutes report.
But there's a lot of bad officiating in the NBA, so it's not like it's not justified for teams and players and coaches and owners.
Point it out though. You're encouraging people to point it out and say there is something. Well, at least do what the NFL does and sweep it under the rug in deep seas. That's still a better thing than just blatantly saying our officials suck.
Yeah. So I get that. But I don't know. The one argument that's been, you know, put out there by Mark Cuban, someone who's been talking about it, is that this stuff doesn't really get addressed unless, you know, the owners, specifically the coaches and the players, make a big stink about it.
All right, Mark Cuban is the voice of reason.
But when you have a bunch of other guys, and their names are slipping me right now, but you have a bunch of other owners and you know, front office guys within the league who are agreeing with him, who are taking his side.
Fair enough.
And I think that Mark Cuban is one of those guys that says what everyone else thinks but isn't brave enough or, you know, doesn't have a platform to say it. So I think it's easy to crap on this. I think it's easy to be like, ah, why are you complaining about that? Keep it within the locker room. But the reality is action is not taken.
It's one thing to complain. It's another thing to release a full report less than 24 hours after the game and name a specific total number of points you were cost. Because did they go through – the officiating in that game was bad all around. And I actually didn't get a chance to look at the report. I read the summary on ESPN. But did they go through – and I don't believe they did. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Did they go through and say how many points the officials cost the Warriors?
By the way, this is for last year's game. Just to look, because I think you're
I read the thing wrong, but still, that's very annoying.
Well, either way, they could do the same thing for what happened yesterday. So, the point still applies. I understand what you're saying.
I totally read that thing wrong today. Then I was reading it on the walk home and totally spaced.
So, yeah, 81 potential missed calls and non-calls from Game 7. And the thing about those audits, too, is they're obviously going to be biased when they're addressing the stuff. And most of those 81 calls were, in fact, good no calls. It was good to keep the whistle in the pocket. Or maybe they were correct in the first place. So, yeah, it's I understand how fans could be upset. I understand how media members could be upset about that. But again, I am, you know, I subscribe to the belief that things will not happen. You know, squeaky wheel gets the grease. Things will not happen unless you speak up. And it's so on par with the NBA and the way things are run. That's what players do. And I think it's part of the reason they do succeed is the transparency between the players and the media and, you know, the attempted transparency between the players and the league, not necessarily the other way around. But I don't have as much of a problem as most people about this one.
All right. Well, besides me being totally discombobulated on what brought that point up, I think that was a pretty good discussion.
Yes.
let's get into the final thoughts. Since we're not going to do a full draft recap since it is a couple days later, but one thought on the NFL draft, Patriots wise or otherwise, what do you got?
Yeah, and I understand you don't want to talk about this. By the way,
you haven't really gotten a chance to talk about it, so I feel like that is sort of unfair.
No, I completely get it. I talked about it a little bit. I talked about it on the morning show. But no, just before we get to that, you and Evan did a tremendous job with your coverage.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
As always, it was awesome.
Thank you to everybody who won. I think it was 8.5 hours live, 9.5 hours total. And it was just an awesome experience. And thank you so much to everybody who tuned into even a minute of it. It means the world to us. So, you know, and we hope you'll stick. It's only going to get better because we got OTAs and training camp. And again, thanks to everybody who tuned in.
As soon as they drafted Jake Bailey, I was like, Barth's going to have a threat on this guy.
So, I don't know if you saw the live reactions to those.
Yeah.
Evan's reaction, the three best reactions of the weekend, me when they drafted Damian Harris, although we weren't live for that because we were on a conference call with, I think, Juwan Williams. Mm-hmm. Me when they drafted Stidham was priceless, and I've come around on the pick now, but you'd think the Patriots murdered my entire family. And Evan when they drafted the punter, his was similar to mine for Stidham. So, I mean, Edling last year, Stidham this year, like as an Alabama fan, they're ripping my heart out, but I'll get to the Stidham pick in a bit.
Okay, I'll leave that one for you. Overall, my it was this great coverage though. That's my main point.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
But I enjoyed the draft. I think you know it's really difficult. I'm not going to act like I'm an expert. I don't know most of these guys, and I won't really know what they're all about until we get to the season. But you're seeing Belichick evolve as he always done, going with the big wide receiver round one. Something he hasn't done personally as a head coach. The Patriots haven't done since Terry Glenn in, what, 96, 97. And then Juwan Williams, another guy, 6'3", a big cornerback who they got. One thing about Juwan Williams, I watched a video of his coach, Derek Mason. No relation to the former wide receiver.
I looked that up, too, because we know Belichick and Mason have a history.
Oh, yes.
So I had to double-check that.
Oh, shut that F up, Mason, of course.
Yeah, scoreboard.
But, yeah, look at the scoreboard. Great clip. Look it up if you haven't yet. but his coach in an interview said he had coached Richard Sherman at Stanford, who's the defensive backs coach back in 2011. And once Richard Sherman graduated, he said, you know, I'm never going to be able to coach another Richard Sherman again. Mind you, Richard Sherman was a fifth-round pick, and this guy saw something in him back then. And they said, then I met Juwan Williams. And you watch this video, watch this interview, and obviously it's kind of a puff piece talking about his past and, you know, talking him up a little bit, making him look like a stand-up guy and a potentially really good teammate. It has to get you pumped up. And it's a guy who seems to have a high motor. Just watching his highlight reel, which can obviously be deceptive, he looks like a ball hawk, someone who can do a really good job against those big guys who Belichick has talked about in the past. You need someone to be able to cover these big wide receivers like, you know, a N'Keal Harry. Juwan Williams seems like he's going to fill that void in the cornerback position has become a strength since that pick, you could argue. Chase Winovich, the new Gronk, you could say.
He is – everybody's talking about they didn't walk away with a replacement for Gronk. It's Chase Winovich. He plays on defense, but – right. He is – although he's like he, – so Gronk was like a jock meathead, right?
Yeah.
And Winovich is more like a nerd meathead. Like he's kind of weird.
He's goofy.
And like the best – so he once ate a live fish for $20. He dated Madonna's daughter. there were, I forget, there were so many stories flying around.
This sounds like a Stephon bit.
Well, there's another guy. So another guy they drafted, Hjalte Froholt, the offensive tackle, the fourth Danish national to play in the NFL, in addition to Hall of Famer Morten Andersen, by the way.
Of course. Of course.
He, growing up, wanted to be an art thief because he thought it would be fun. So they got some guys with interesting backstories.
Like Goodfellas. That's great.
Yeah.
And then obviously Jared Stittman, which you're going to touch on well. Yeah. People are – it's one of those things. It's funny how these storylines kind of manifest and how it's like, oh, okay, they got it. They got a fourth round with the last pick in the fourth round, or one of the last picks before the conditional, that sandwich round comes to effect. They got Jared Stidham. Seventh quarterback as well, which is kind of similar to Tom Brady.
Same as Tom Brady.
Same as him. There you go. And, you know, people have been bringing up how he can take the hit. He stays in the pocket, has a tight spiral, has a great arm, all that good stuff. And I think people start convincing themselves that he will be Tom Brady's successor and he'll be great, rather than the reality.
If it happened with Etling, who really should not have been drafted.
He was a seventh-round pick. He was picked three rounds later.
And people were convinced he was the next guy. So,
but that's what this guy's fighting for. He's fighting to replace Etling. He's not fighting to be the successor. This is, you know, low risk, high reward.
He's interesting. He's kind of like halfway between. He's exactly halfway between. And originally, look, I'm an Alabama fan. He beat him in the Iron Bowl. Like, we all have our biases. That's sort of what the initial reaction was for me. It was, oh, Jared Stidham, this guy killed me. And he had a really bad – so the interesting thing about Stidham is he had a really good 2017. He was one of the best quarterbacks in the nation in 2017, and he fell off a cliff in 2018. If he had replicated what he did in his junior year, they did in his senior year, he probably would have been a first-round pick. He might have been the number one pick. But that's the other thing that bugs me about him is I believe football is a what-have-you-done-for-me recently sport. If it had been the other way around, I'd feel a lot more confident. He had a very rough year. But – even coaches at Auburn admit he was not a fit for the scheme they wanted to run. He was not a fit for their offense, and the offensive line was really not what it needed to be to protect him. He wants to be a pocket passer. They did not have an offensive line built for that. So, again, he falls right in between Jimmy Garoppolo and Danny Etling to me. Garoppolo was drafted to be the next guy. The timing didn't work out. He was supposed to be a starting top-tier NFL quarterback, whereas Etling was drafted really because he's the perfect scout team quarterback. That's what everybody says about him, is he can mimic any kind of quarterback, the body language, the types of throws, all of it. He was never meant to play in the NFL. He is meant to be there to help out with the practice squad. Stidham, to me, is in the middle. Etling's ceiling is as a backup quarterback. You don't even know if he's going to be a backup. He's probably a career third string at best. Stidham should be able to step right in, and, I mean, he's about what Brian Hoyer is right now. We'll see if they run with three quarterbacks, whatever. But he is a legitimate NFL backup right now. And, you know, worst case scenario, I think he can be a guy like Chase Daniel. You'll get 10 solid backup years out of him. Billy Volek's another guy, right? And if you take a guy like Billy Volek or Chase Daniel in the fourth round, Franz is in good hands to think of as your starter. That's not a bad pick. But unlike some of those career backup guys, when they're drafted who you know are career backups, he actually does have some upside to be a starter. Throws one of the tightest spirals already in the NFL. He throws one of the best balls in the NFL. His footwork is there. His football IQ is higher than you realize because, again, he had to make a lot of panic decisions at Auburn last year. And the maturity and the leadership ability. Here's a guy who transferred out of Baylor because we all know what happened to that program. Had to sit out a year. So instead of just, you know, he could have dicked around, done whatever, a year off from football. He actually went to a local high school and volunteered to run their scout team. And he essentially was a member of a high school football team as a sophomore in college all year without getting to play a regulation down. That's a guy who loves the game. So I like the Stidham pick, but you know, if they have a chance to take a guy like Trevor Lawrence and if he falls down the board a little bit, they have a chance to grab him. This doesn't rule out them going after one of those, you know, blue ribbon quarterbacks for me. So that's what I think of that pick. One other thing I want to touch on is people talk about they didn't get a tight end. They're not replacing Rob Gronkowski with a tight end. They're replacing Rob Gronkowski by reworking the offense. And what they're going to do here is devalue – and I know I'm going on and on and on, but I'm almost done.
No.
You can get the rest of this rant all over the CLNS YouTube page, all the stuff from the weekend. They're going to devalue the tight end position and increase the value of the running back position. And, you know, you talk about Belichick's history and what he's done. Remember, when he came into league, everybody was using fullbacks. And then he stopped. And then everybody else stopped. And then he brought it back. That's essentially what he's doing with the tight end position. the tight end position was wildly different before he drafted Rob Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez. He did. Now every team looks for those kind of guys as tight ends. And now that it's become the league norm, I think Belichick's just going to devalue it. They have a bunch of big maulers, some guys who can contribute in the passing game but are mostly blockers. He's going to up the value and do it more with running backs. And then you bring in a big wide receiver who physically profiles like a tight end in N'Keal Harry, who actually is a similar physical profile to Rob Gronkowski, and those red zone threats, those that contact passing, that's going to run more through a guy like that. So just because they did not bring in a tight end does not mean they did not replace Rob Gronkowski. To me, Damian Harris is the replacement for Rob Gronkowski. He rounds out the backfield nicely, and running back is going to play a huge role in the Patriots offense. Actually, one more small nugget, because I'm really proud of myself for discovering this one. Byron Cowart, who they took in the fifth round, the defensive lineman out of Maryland. Flashback to 2015, he was the number one high school recruit in the country, coming out of Western Florida on the Gulf, 250-pound edge rusher, could fly off the edge, plays with a nasty mean streak, love everything about it. He gets to Auburn, and all of a sudden he's 270 pounds, and he's playing as a hand-down defensive end. And he's still pretty good, but he doesn't quite have that same footwork and explosiveness he did when he was in high school. He transfers out of Auburn, which he has since admitted he made a mistake going to Auburn. He should have gone to Florida. Ends up at Maryland playing as a 290-pound defensive tackle and just looks out of place. He still has the mean streak. There's still flashes, but he's not an interior defensive lineman. You can tell that's not what his skill set is. You look at a guy like Brian Bowen from Florida State, who went in the first round of the draft. They were in the same high school class. They were both compared to be similar players. A source at Florida State tells me they considered putting the weight on Bowen like Auburn did with Cowart. They didn't. So the Patriots are at an interesting crossroads with Cowart. Do they teach him how to be a defensive tackle at 290 pounds, or do they see if they can get him back into that 270-pound range and turn him into a bigger end rusher, maybe like a slightly slower Jadeveon Clowney, that kind of guy? So he has an immense upside, maybe more than anybody they took in the draft, but it's not, you know, like N'Keal Harry has nice upside, but that's just going to come with him playing in the league. That's just going to happen. Cowart has immense upside, but the Patriots are really going to have to work to bring it out of him. They're at an interesting crossroads, what they do with him. That's going to be one of my favorite stories to monitor in camp. One of the first things I'm going to look at when I get that roster in training camp is what did Byron Cowart weigh in as, because that's going to tell us a lot. And that's the end of my draft rant. I didn't even talk about the punter.
I'm sure you already gave a grade during your coverage over the weekend.
B plus. I had him at A- going into day three. I think they had a chance to take some impact wide receivers, like potential upside wide receivers that they didn't. I think Bailey's a good player. I don't know that pick was necessary. And again, I like the Stidham pick. There were other players on the board. A guy like Mac Wilson was on the board, an inside linebacker, which I think they could have used. And they got a good one as a UDFA. But, Stidham and Bailey are certainly good picks, but I think that they could have made better picks. So I had them at an A- through 2 days. B+, still a very good grade. And that's probably on the lower side. I still was flirting with an A-, but I mean, it's the best I felt initially about a Patriots draft class in a long time, probably since the Dont'a Hightower Chandler Jones draft. So take that for what it's worth, but I liked it. And that was a really long rant, and I know like it's getting late for you. So that will do it for us. We'll be back later this week. Bruins, Celtics, Red Sox, whatever the story is, we'll touch on it. Kind of tough to tell at this point. But we'll have another episode for you later this week. To see when that's released, make sure you're following us on Twitter at Calling It Podcast. And you can check out all of our episodes online at clnsmedia.com. Click the podcast tab and then click on the Calling It logo. And again, if you want any more of our draft coverage, any more of my draft thoughts, along with Evan Lazar, you can check out clnsmedia.com for that. I will have a roster projection dropping on CLNS Media tomorrow morning. Way too early roster projection, but what else am I doing with my time? So you can check that out there. That's it for this episode. For Alex Leibowitz, I'm Alex Barr. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.